Hi and welcome. My name is Olivia Bleha and I work on the partnership teams at VIA. Welcome to The Dispatch. This is a podcast series where we interview people who are building the transportation of the future. Today, I am very excited to be joined by Roger Lentz. Roger is the Chief Planning and Development Officer for the city of Wilson, North Carolina. Wilson is gearing up to launch their VIA powered service this fall. So we're very excited to sit down, speak with Roger about the city, how they're thinking about transit, and learn a little bit more about their deployment. So thanks for joining me, Roger.
Thank you, Olivia. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. Do you want to start off and just tell us a little bit about your background and how you got involved with sort of city development generally?
Sure. Yeah, I've been in the business probably longer than I want to say, but about 23 years and have worked in various places in the Charlotte metro, spent a lot of time there, about half my career in the Charlotte metro area, worked for the city of Charlotte for a little while, but have never really been involved in transit, been involved in transportation, but not transit, you know, specifically. That is not really my forte, but when I came here, I've been here in Wilson about 13 years and, you know, involved in a lot of different things here. But the main thing is try to revitalize the center city, you know, economic development for downtown, revitalization of, you know, historically disadvantaged neighborhoods, as well as all the other things that go along with like new industrial development and, you know, new shopping centers and the like. But, you know, one of the things that I noticed and the city manager and I talked about was our kind of transit system and, you know, just noticing where ridership was going and, you know, starting to do a little, you know, like asking questions or whatever. And then we said, you know, we need to do something different. Maybe there's something better that we could do. So, you know, I kind of volunteered to take that on. I had an interest in it. So I guess that's how we got to where, you know, we're at now. I spoke up. Oops. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, you volunteered.
Yeah, right.
I love it. Well, it got us somewhere good, so it worked out.
Yeah, that's right. I'm glad I did.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit about Wilson in general. So who lives there? What's it like to live in Wilson? Just a little bit more about the community.
Yeah, Wilson's a city of around 50,000 people. It's a very diverse community. And like a lot of southern cities, you know, there's a, you know, kind of the haves and the have nots, if you will, you know, higher poverty areas, as well as very well-to-do areas. Not unlike, you know, most major cities in America, right? You know, very diverse from a race or income, background, whatever. So Wilson's not unlike cities like that. We have a agricultural history, although we're no longer an agricultural town. This used to be called the world's greatest tobacco market. It was a slogan, and there hasn't been a, you know, in-person tobacco market here in decades. So the economic development now is all around manufacturing, high-tech manufacturing and pharmaceuticals, aerospace, automotive. We have a big tire manufacturing plant here, for example. You know, we also have, this is the founding place of a big financial institution, BB&T, which there's just a merger with BB&T and SunTrust. So they're now going to be called Truist. In fact, they're building a new facility in our downtown as we speak. But this was all, you know, it's also a financial hub in that sense. So very diverse economy. And in fact, through these COVID times, it's proved to be very resilient. We're not seeing the you know, certainly the retail and restaurant, like anywhere else, is seeing, you know, some significant disruption, but our manufacturing sector is very strong, even through this COVID time.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. And I know that the city of Wilson sort of isn't a stranger to taking on exciting projects in the name of development. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the Greenlight project. I think our audience would be interested just hearing briefly about the project and then maybe what it sort of says to you about how Wilson operates as a whole.
Yeah. So, you know, when I came looking at this job, it's been almost 14 years ago, I was impressed with the level of investment that the city was making in infrastructure. They had, you know, built a new reservoir, for example, because they're having these water issues and they're like, you know, we don't not that they didn't care what the expense was, but you know, it's a highly expensive item. And they said, you know, if we want to continue growing, we got to fix this. And so they did. And they spent years and years doing that and quite a bit of money. But when I came, they were talking about broadband and you know, basically gigabit service fiber network. And really the reason was is continue the ability to continue to compete on a global marketplace. So you think, oh, city of 50,000, this is not New York. You're not competing in a global arena for you know, economic development projects. Well, you know, one of the last pharmaceutical companies that we landed, the competition was like Philadelphia, Chicago, and a couple other places. Amsterdam, I think, might've been the other place somewhere in Europe. I want to say Amsterdam, I could be wrong. The point is that, you know, even though Wilson's only 50,000 people, it's competing on a global stage. And so it needs global infrastructure, and broadband was seen as an essential piece of infrastructure for this community. And in fact, they, you know, the first council had first, you know, tried to partner with the private sector. You know, one of the legacy companies that was around and you know, they weren't interested. We're too small, not enough money, you know, it's whatever excuse, you know, you want to see, the excuse was given. And they said, well, that's fine. We need to figure out how to do it ourselves because we think it's that critical. So, and that's, you know, how we ended up with Greenlight. So the Greenlight is the name they came up with. It's an all fiber network. Anybody, any address in the city can get gigabit internet service, should they choose. And, you know, the other thing with the, I think the private companies, you know, for-profit companies, and we've seen this with there was a company, I won't name company names, but there was a company, you know, working in Raleigh trying to deploy fiber, and the, you know, the fiber is being deployed in the more well-to-do areas. The city did not look at income, did not look at background, did not look at, you know, where do we think we can make the most money. It was, if we're going to do this, it has to run past every address, no matter what. And so, you know, it's just like a water line. They looked at it in that way. And so fiber is all over our city. Anybody can access it. And in fact, during these times of COVID, we've actually offered what we call a lifeline service. So for really, really cheap, I think it's like 10 bucks, you can get really good internet service. So the kids there, we were talking before this about school, you know, yeah. So school's being done on like Zoom and all that. You know, you can't do that very well on a like a DSL connection or something like that. And so the service we provide through Lifeline gives, you know, that family a chance to, for their children to be able to participate in, you know, these web meetings, you know, the video chats and things that they're doing through school. So it's really important. And, you know, what I think is, you know, A, it further shows we're willing to invest in infrastructure. But second, what really impressed me about that was, you know, the equity issue, right? You know, we need to fix this digital divide issue. And we, you know, and even if we don't get as many signups as we would want in some of these neighborhoods, it's still important that everybody have access, and we'll help people get access, you know, as that becomes important.
Yeah, I love that. I think that story is really an interesting example of cities thinking differently and creatively about how to increase equity and access. So thanks for sharing that. Yeah. I'm curious, sort of, when you think about like the current transit system, the fixed route system that Wilson has been operating, could you maybe talk about some of the challenges with that network that led you to start thinking, hey, there must be a better way?
Sure. So let's start with this, so that everybody, you know, that might watch this or listen to it kind of understands what Wilson is. Yeah. So, you know, I can get in a car and I can be anywhere I want in this city in 15 minutes or less. Often 10 minutes. We are not traffic congested. You know, you don't have to sit through multiple signals trying to get somewhere, you know, at the same signal, trying to, you know, wait for the third cycle before you can get through. This is not a traffic congested town. But we are a transportation challenged town. And so we have a lot of people that don't have access to cars, and not a lot. There's a percentage of our population that don't have access to cars. Yeah. And, you know, we have a bus system that runs that is completely a needs-based system. Well, why is it a needs-based system? Well, it's on our headways. So, you know, you're not going to get anywhere fast, you know, on our bus system. And that's a challenge. And so when you think about it from someone like, let's take myself. Okay. So I've got a car, you know, I do well. I'm not going to take our transit system because I'm not going to give up an hour of my day. In fact, sometimes you have to make a transfer You know, in fact, for me, where the closest bus route, if I wanted to get to one of the shopping areas, I would actually have to ride the bus downtown, transfer, and then ride back out. So not only is it an hour headway and I got to like, okay, am I going to be late for the bus or whatever? And then I got to go and make a transfer and all that. Instead, I could have jumped in my car and been to, you know, like a grocery store in 8 minutes, via car. So for me, I'm not going to ride the transit. It doesn't come close to competing, you know, with my other available modes of transportation. That individual that is the needs-based rider probably doesn't enjoy some of the same employment benefits that I have. So I've paid sick leave, for example. They want to go to the doctor's office and they're working at a, you know, let's say a restaurant, they're a retail or restaurant worker, and they have to take that appointment during the day. They're not getting paid. They're losing income. So, you know, and then for them to have to give up, you know, time this thing so it's when the bus comes, probably make a transfer to get where they want to go. And then, you know, I asked a question a couple years ago, and I asked in this one area of town, I said, if I was in this area of town and I wanted to get to the area around the hospital, I said, how long would it take? And they said, at least an hour. That same car drive was 10 minutes. And I said, that's not fair to those individuals. It's not fair. It's not equitable. So can we do something different to, you know, we probably aren't going to beat the car. I'm not going to promise anybody we're going to, you know, beat the car if it's only a 10 or 15 minute drive. But to give up an hour just to get there, then you've got the appointment. And then if the appointment doesn't end when the bus comes, you know, you might have a 30 minute wait till the next bus comes. You know, to give up 2.5 or 3 hours of your day for a 30 minute doctor's appointment, that's a problem for people in that situation.
Yeah. And it places a greater burden on people who already are vulnerable or, you know, could require more assistance. In fact, are actually being penalized when it's more difficult to access those places in their communities.
Absolutely. I mean, that was a huge issue for me, from my lens and what I was looking at. That was a huge issue and liability for our current users.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. So how did you start to think about the idea of microtransit or on-demand transit as the right choice for Wilson?
Sure. I mean, so, you know, I get to travel a lot. You know, I've used, you know, your Ubers and Lyfts and things of that nature, you know, when they first started rolling out. I said, well, this is cool. You know, get to use my phone and a ride appears. And, you know, that's kind of convenient. And so anyway, we started talking about, there's just got to be a better way for transit. So Grant Goings, our city manager, and I would, you know, chat every once in a while about, there's just got to be a better way. Somebody's got to be doing something that is better than what, you know, we have. And so I started looking at it maybe 4 or 5 years ago now. And really there wasn't much out there at that point in time. I mean, you know, there's on demand, but, you know, there's still, you know, on demand's not new, but, you know, oh, you make your reservation like the day ahead. Okay, well, I need a gallon of milk. I don't get, you know, I don't know that a day ahead. It's like, oh, I didn't plan ahead for that. Oops. You know, right. So that's not, yeah, so you could do it, but that's not like modern, in my opinion. And it's certainly not Uber-like, right? And so, you know, is there something different? So we, you know, started looking some more. And really, a couple years into it, I found another company that it was like a software solution,
sure,
which was good. But that put a lot of risk to us. And so we were starting to look at that, budget it out. And I started thinking about, you know, kind of the risk. And frankly, that, you know, having to buy a whole brand new fleet of vehicles and, you know, take the responsibility for driver training and all that. I mean, we would not have been, you know, we would have had to hire additional, probably full-time staff just to run it, just to get it kind of up and going. And I didn't find anybody sort of consulting in that space. I just found sort of the software provider.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, our calculation was the risk was just, you know, if it doesn't work in the first year, we're in big trouble here. And so, you know, so then we kept looking more. And we're, you know, the goal would be, could we find a third party provider? And so that's where we kind of landed on that. And I think there's lots of advantages, but I mean, just the risk side of it, I think is a key piece.
Yeah. As far as sort of being able to bring in somebody who can provide the tech and the operation, so the city isn't having to suddenly figure out how to operate an entirely new type of transit.
Right. And how do you transition it? And I'm not going to get extra money. So how do I transition from the bus to this and we're not, none of us have done it before, right? So yeah, you bring me a software package, that's great. That's really good software, but you know, what happens if we have hiccups? And then, you know, we started looking at, well, you could do a pilot for one route. Well, for us, I mean, I described to you kind of the way I can't show you how the route system is, but you know, if you have to transfer, so you're going to be able to jump on this bus and it'll be like a first mile, last mile solution in an uncongested, you know, transfer over. And then you had to coordinate that with 1 hour headways. It still wasn't going to be very convenient. When I looked at it, it's like, this is not really a great, you know, enhancement to the service that you're providing people on this sort of like one pilot route. It wasn't calculating out, in my opinion. So that's why we started looking for, you know, sort of turnkey one group to provide, you know, software and operations as a solution.
Yeah. I actually had forgotten that candidly that you were all looking at doing maybe a one route replacement with on-demand transit at first, and then transition to thinking about what if we replace the entire network?
But
it's a really interesting sort of how your thought process evolved from saying, hey, maybe we should start small, one route, but then you ultimately said, hey, you know, if we're going to do this, we should do it and give it the best chance of success.
I think we looked at it as, you know, let's just rip the Band-Aid off. Let's go.
Yeah. I love it. We're excited about it.
Yeah.
We'll put a little map up on the article that we write so everyone can see the routes as well.
Right.
Great. What would you say were the biggest challenges or hurdles that your team had to sort of go through to get this project off the ground?
Well, it's kind of like I was just describing, the fact that, you know, there's just not a lot of transit innovation in cities of our size outside of metro areas. So yeah, there might be some innovation in California or something in a city that's, you know, a suburb of, you know, San Francisco or Los Angeles or something like that. But you know, we're a standalone, non-metropolitan, non-MPO city. There's just not a lot of transit innovation going on in cities of our, you know, similar cities, I'll say. And so I thought I was going to find more when I started doing this research, and was surprised not to find it. And so I was surprised that it took this long to sort of find a different way. And then, you know, obviously you guys have been quickly deploying, and, you know, I think, you know, you all started with, it's kind of how I remember several years back, because VIA was doing sort of the private, you know, like it was just your own system that you own the whole thing. Right. And I saw that, but at that time, at least, you know, in my web searches, could not find where, you know, you all were doing some similar things. Then I saw the article about another city you were working with. I said, wait a minute, maybe they've changed. So, you know, that's when we had had connected. So, you know, I felt that that was a challenge. I mean, that it took that long to find something that would really fit with what we're trying to do was the biggest challenge.
Yeah, and particularly as a relatively small city, like it's kind of unusual, honestly, that a city your size is offering like such a, you know, even as robust a fixed route network as you have, and that you have sort of the flexibility to think differently without support from the MPO or support from a county or a transit authority. So it's definitely interesting that you guys have been able to innovate so quickly.
There's two cities in North Carolina, one smaller than ours, but they're a university town. So Boone has a fixed route. So if you take them out because they're a university town, then we are the smallest city in North Carolina.
Yeah.
With a fixed route system.
Got it. That's
yeah. Pretty
cool. And I think now you'll be the first city with an entirely on-demand system. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, one like this for sure. Yes.
Yeah, I love it. Okay. Did anything, I guess, besides the fact that there just weren't so many providers out there, did anything else kind of surprise you about the process? Or any other advice that you would give to other cities who are thinking about doing something like this?
Well, probably like most professions, I know as a planner, people like to use acronyms and, you know, jargon that might not make sense to other people. In fact, we talk about that sometimes, like stop using the jargon. You know, you got to get it into the things that people understand. If you stand up and, you know, use this word at a council meeting, they're going to look at you blankly because they have no idea what the word you just gave them means. And transit is no different. And so it really was a steep learn, not coming from a transit world. That was a really steep learning curve for me to try to break into, and I know I wasn't perfect on that. I'm still learning things all the time. Like I had no idea what that meant, you know, whatever. So it's kind of very difficult to break into. And I think that makes it difficult, you know, to kind of figure out how to innovate in that space. You know, maybe I should have taken a class or something. You know, I don't know if they offer that, but, you know, maybe I should have gone to a conference or something to sort of learn a little bit more. I did go to the state transit conference. I was asked to speak when we were first looking at that as to why we were looking at it and whatnot. But still, it's I think when you're in that world, like all these little funding codes and all that, I mean, that is a puzzle to put together if you're not in that world. And so that was very difficult, I would say, for me.
Yeah, that definitely is a good one and something that, yeah, I think is important to make sure that whatever we're doing is, you know, compliant and makes sense from a transit perspective. I think that's something that we think about at VIA is how can we bring together folks who have a lot of experience operating on-demand transit with people who have more traditional transit planning backgrounds and sort of mesh the best of both worlds together. Because there's obviously things to be learned from both.
Well, in like planning law, you know, planning law has happened over the years and there's all kinds of things that are out there that sort of, I don't want to use the word block, but, you know, just it's an impediment sometimes, or you got to figure out a way around it or figure a way to change it, you know, get with your delegation, you know, either whether it's federal or state delegation to the state house or Congress to, you know, get some help and like, hey, this rule, it's here. And I know it's been there for 20 years, but, you know, what if we looked at it in this way, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, so that happens in the planning world. So it's not surprising that that happens in the transit world. But, you know, if we're going to try to innovate very quickly, you know, it might be, you know, it might be something that state and federal policymakers do need to look at as far as, you know, so that we can quickly innovate when new ideas come up, because the pace of innovation out there, maybe not in, you know, whether it's in transit or any other aspect of just life, you know, there's all kinds of things that weren't here 10 years ago that are now strongly this thing right here. You know, that didn't exist 10 years ago. And now no one, you know, how do I function without it? I don't know.
True. For those of you who can't see Roger, he was holding up an iPhone. But
all right, yeah, sorry.
Right, though. Well, great. That's all really helpful background for kind of how we got to where we are. So I know the Wilson service is launching in the fall. Maybe you could tell everyone a little bit about the service itself. So what will it be like? How many vehicles, where will they go? Things like that might be helpful.
Sure. So because of our limitations on fixed route, you know, we could not expand fixed route coverage. If we did, it would just be instead of an hour headway, you know, hour and 15 minutes, maybe an hour and 20 minutes. That's getting, you know, really bad. So, you know, the system could not grow. There wasn't additional funding. In fact, funding has been shrinking. It's already 2/3 funded by the city. There's quite a bit of local tax dollars, you know, going into the system. And, you know, so we were getting these demands of, hey, we need service here, but we could not provide it. Or if we did provide it, we're having to use another provider. Those rides are very expensive. And you're trying to connect people to employment opportunities and stuff. So, you know, here we're going to start out, I think, with 8 vehicles. Hopefully, you know, we might get to 10 vehicles. I think we're working out some of those funding issues with COVID. There's been some funding issues out there. So we've had to adjust on the fly, but hopefully we'll get back to 10 vehicles to cover the city. And, you know, we're going to cover, I would say, I would estimate maybe 2/3 of the city, where maybe our current system covers half or maybe less than half of the city. So, we're going to be able to expand the service area with, you know, we know where there's been sort of these out of system requests for rides. We wanted to make sure we covered that. And then two, there's some major employment areas that just could not be covered by the fixed route system. So, you know, we want to be able to get people to jobs. So, you know, I think beyond then getting to shopping, you know, making sure people have access to good employment opportunity was very important to us. We're going to operate about the same hours as our current bus system. Hopefully we get a grant or two to help. You know, we'd like to test evening hours to see if there's a lot of demand. We think there is. But, you know, again, funding. We're going to have to find the funding for that. But, you know, that's probably one of our first priorities would be to, you know, get some evening coverage and see how that works out.
Yeah. makes sense. And as far as how people in Wilson will actually access the service, I know something that's been a theme as you and I have talked and the launch team has talked has been making sure this is as accessible as possible. Can you just talk about the different elements of the service that we've implemented to make sure that that's the case?
Correct. So obviously we have two very important aspects to this service. Number one, we want it to appeal to, you know, the proverbial millennial. I don't know how many, you know, you still keep hearing that, but the young person that's coming in, maybe they got the job at, you know, BB&T, or maybe they're working out at one of these pharmaceutical companies. You know what? They want to access it with the iPhone, right? Or whatever other, you know, smart device they might use. They want it to be quick and accessible. So yep. Our transit system is not that currently. In fact, if you don't have $1.25 in your wallet, you won't be able to ride because we don't take any kind of electronic payment. So, you know, we, in fact, that limiting for me, I don't carry a lot of cash. I'm mostly paying with my iPhone and in a card or whatever. And if I can't pay that way, I'm not buying it.
So,
you know, we want to, you know, begin to appeal to that new population, right? And at the same time, we have these riders that have been with us for a long time. Well, they might not have the smartphone, might not be able to afford it. They may be unbanked, may not have access to electronic payment forms. So it's very important to us to provide tools to both groups so that no one gets left out. So, you know, we're going to be working on, you know, helping people, with whether they be prepaid vouchers, or in fact, I think our first month right now is set to be, you know, at no cost. So, you know, we do not want anybody to have an excuse like I was not able to pay. No, we are going to get you to the place. We're going to get you here. We're going to help you get the payment methods. We'll help you with the vouchers. We are going to help you to make sure that you can ride. And so, you know, not only can you access on the smartphone, but then, you know, it was very critical to us to have a phone number.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of people that, in fact, I was just dealing with a lady yesterday about the census, and unfortunately, the census has gone completely online. And I can show you in our city a few census tracts where that's just not going very well. This lady happens to live in one of those census tracts. And when I talked about going on the internet, starting in that way, I don't have that, you know, and I don't, you know, what you want me to do what? I'm not doing that. And I said, well, hell, how about this phone number? Even that, I had to explain why it was important to do the census, but at least now she's like, oh, I can do that. I'll call that number. So she got a card with the phone number. You know, hopefully she'll go home and, you know, fill the census out. But, you know, we have a segment of our population that are still phone, you know, phone based, maybe even landline based, that need, if they're going to access this service the way we, you know, want, they're going to have the ability. So having that phone number was critical.
Got it. That totally makes sense. Yeah, I think those are really important things to consider for any service, but particularly one that involves some element of technology, is how to make sure everyone can use it as well.
That's right.
Yeah. I guess the next thing I'm curious is, are there any other like interesting things as far as sort of rider education or handling the transition that are important to think through? Like, how are you helping riders to understand what the change will be over the next couple of months?
Yeah, so fortunately we have, you know, VIA's got a great team. I think I'll put our team up against any city's team as far as from a marketing perspective. And so, you know, I am probably not the most creative person when it comes to that. So I'm glad there's these great people, you know, doing this work. And I'm glad they, you know, tolerate my participation in some of the meetings. I have high confidence that, we're still, because of COVID, our system actually dropped back to kind of an on-demand service. And so, you know, those folks that are still, you know, definitely needs-based riders, they got to have us to get where they want to go. You know, they're going to get personal contact. That, you know, we're going to be talking to them. We're going to be handing them the phone numbers. We're going to be doing a lot of explaining and handholding to make sure that we, you know, are able to touch as many of them as possible. At the same time, you know, there's a new brand that they're rolling out. I don't know, we're yet ready to roll the brand out yet, but I think there'll be an announcement soon, new logo and all that, because, you know, we want to give a fresh look to, you know, the system and let everybody know that it is new. And so I think through branding, you know, we'll be able to do that. And hopefully that helps us attract, you know, the other group of riders that I mentioned, which are, you know, that young person that really doesn't want to own a car. There's a lot of people, you know, when I was 16 years old, by God, I needed to have a car. And I lived in a place that didn't have transit. And, you know, I was like, I'm going to get a car, you know, and I bought my car and it was great. And then, you know, oh, I got to put gas in the car. Oh, I got, you know, there's all these expenses, right? Well, you know, they're now the young people are a little bit smarter. And hopefully they're going to have tools to, you know, where if they want to avoid the expense of that automobile and they want to live in a community like ours, you know, hopefully this is the first step, you know, in that direction. The second step obviously is we're going to have to provide service in later hours, you know, but we'll get there. You know, I'm confident that we'll be able to get there. I'm confident we're going to be able to show success, which leads to more funding.
Yeah, I hope so too. No, I'm excited. I think the level of personal attention is really interesting to hear about. And it's honestly because sort of your existing team has built up such good like engagement and knowledge of who the community members are that will benefit from that sort of engagement that we'll be able to do it effectively. So I'm really excited to see how that goes.
Me too. Me too.
Awesome. I will wrap up soon. I guess the only other thing I'd be curious to hear from you is I think other cities of Wilson's size are going to be particularly interested in hearing about how you guys are funding the project, like where funding's coming from, how you're thinking about current funding, tomorrow funding. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, and I'm not, you know, so I'm not going to be able to throw out all the acronyms and all that. So I apologize for that. But, you know, there is a mix of, you know, there's state funding that is running our current system. You know, much of that funding will, you know, at least to this point, my understanding will remain. I think we'll end up with the same ratio of, you know, about 2/3 local, 1/3, you know, a grant of, you know, some sorts of, you know, transit sort of grants. We've also applied for an FTA AIM grant that's, you know, hopefully going to help us, you know, pilot some different ideas as far as, you know, after hours, or I don't want to call it, you know, evening hour service, or, you know, whatnot, maybe Sunday service. You know, who knows, we'll figure out the best way to do that depending on if we're awarded and how much is awarded. But you know, that's certainly one of the risks that, you know, going in, not knowing that funding world. Luckily we had very good partners on staff and with VIA that kind of have better understanding of it than I do to sort of navigate that, maze of, options, you know, there. So, I'm very confident that, you know, that's going to work out. You know, we're going to not lose any funding, and be able to provide, you know, show a better level of service, with the dollars that we're investing, you know, in transit.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. And I will clarify, I think you cut out for a second, Roger, but I think you were saying that you're kind of using a combination. There's local funding, some state funding, and then FTA 5311 funding.
Yeah, that's all, you know, because we get all our money through the state. So there's, you know, some federal pass-throughs that come to the state DOT and then come back to us. So we don't directly deal with FTA given our size. That might change with the census.
Yeah.
You know, not sure yet, but, you know, we got a couple of years, I think, to think about that and prepare for it. And then we, you know, the FTA grant, now the FTA grant that would go through DOT as well, but, you know, if we were able to get the AIM grant, that would help us pilot some new things to test some things out as far as hours of operation or days or whatnot. So
have a little transit innovation kitchen in Wilson. That would be
right. We'll try.
Yeah, I hope so. well, great. I think that is it. Anything else that you would want to say to other cities who are considering something like this, who are having issues with transportation, any other words of advice or things that might be interesting for them to consider?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would summarize it in this way. So my father-in-law lives in a city about half the size of Wilson, and he's wheelchair bound, had a stroke pretty young. And, you know, he basically lost almost all of his freedom, right? And, you know, he's not on Medicaid or anything like that. And, you know, he has to rely on others to, you know, for grocery stores, even though he could do those things himself. And, you know, this, they have a system there where you got to make reservations a day or two ahead of time. And, you know, some of it's limited and all that. So he's just, I mean, I guess because of those limitations, he just hasn't really wanted to try it because he's not confident in how to use it. Guy's actually got an iPhone, a smartphone. He's got an iPad. So, you know, he knows how to use that. Every once in a while, I get a text from him, you know. You know, I think a system like this, if we take it down to that level, or, you know, my parents are aging. At some point, they're not. My great grandmother actually, you know, lost. She was more independent, but lost her ability to drive. If you take an individual like that in a car oriented society, that's used to being able to jump in a car and run an errand when they need to on a whim, and you lose that ability. All of us are privileged because we haven't lost that ability. Yeah. When you take someone that does, and you think about having to plan ahead a day or 2 days, that is not convenient. It is almost prison-like, if you want to be, you know, blunt about it. And I think if this is successful, and, you know, if Via is successful around the country, I know you guys are global and doing other things, people in that situation, in a city that's not, you know, we're not New York density, we can't run subways and, you know, the like. I mean, I know there's other issues with the subway. They're trying to work on ADA accessibility and all those sorts of things. I've ridden it many times. I understand the challenges there. But a system like this helps the individuals like that. And I think everything else is really cool. I think, you know, helping young people, you know, that don't want to own a car, helping them is cool. I think helping that person that's unbanked is great. It's absolutely necessary to get that needs-based rider. But some people become needs-based riders because of circumstances of age or some unintended medical thing. And if they could still live an independent life, having transit tools like this, I think, really is an important issue for us to consider, especially in cities, you know, of our size, not only around the state, but I think around the country.
Yeah, I think so too. I love it, and I'm really, really excited to see what the service is like when it launches in the next couple months. I cannot wait.
I can't wait either. I can't wait to see the first riders. I can't wait to be able to sit at home and you know, get my own first ride.
Yeah, right. You'll have to take one. Well, thank you so much, Roger. This was really great. Everyone else, I hope you enjoyed the conversation that we've just had. We will post Roger's interview and a little article and some maps so you can see what life is like in Wilson as well. And definitely stay tuned for more episodes of The Dispatch. Thank you for listening.